Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Mina Kimes Show, featuring Lenny. Mina talks all things football with her unique brand of humor and insight. Her friends join each episode to talk about the NFL's latest storylines, along with her football-loving dog, Lenny, making frequent contributions. Download and subscribe to The Mina Kimes Show and The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Also, The Undefeated on ESPN Plus offers fans year-round premium content highlighting the intersectionality of race, culture, and sports. Check out new premium storytelling, your favorite ESPN films, and more exclusively on ESPN Plus. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about what's going on with J.J. Watt. We're going to talk about Urban Meyer, who apparently lost his mind, or did he? And your stories about your cars getting towed and or booted. But first... All right, so Shannon and I had Russell Wilson on when The Right Time was a radio show. And nobody, I repeat, nobody puts more effort into not saying a damn thing than Russell Wilson. Like, he is leaving the house and his plan is, I'm not going to tell you anything that you want to know. I might answer your question, but... I'm not telling you anything I don't feel like telling you. That's the get down. And in our interview, for those of you, you know, who go back a ways with us, y'all know the legendary line that Russell kept giving us was, you know, man, I'm just from a small town, Richmond, Virginia. Like, this dude had Richmond sound like it got 2 stoplights. You know what I'm saying? Like, he had just decided he was leaning all the way in on, you know, I'm just, and he said it like 4 times, you know, man, I'm just small town, Richmond, Virginia. I'm like, oh, you are full on going into this one. But you'd have it every now and then where you'd ask that dude a question and he'd laugh when he heard it. And the laugh meant, oh, wow, you think I'm really going to answer that? And so he'll chuckle and it'll take a moment and then he'll figure out how to not actually say anything. He's a quarterback. That's how this works. They really don't tell you very much, right? That's the game. He is trained in this way of talking to you because it's a nice thing to do, but not ever actually telling you anything. So it was kind of wild last week when he went on the Dan Patrick show and he basically made it clear that I need a little help from the offensive line, right? Like, he tried everything he could to temper it and to make the point that we got to do better. I got to do better about preventing sacks because he does have to do better about preventing sacks. The Seahawks have a bad combination when it comes to him, which is they have generally had poor offensive line play, and they've also had a quarterback who is responsible for a lot of sacks. Like, you talk to the analytics guys, they will tell you, sacks is a quarterback stat. Like, Russell is a dude that's going to get back there and wait a while for something to happen and run around, and that's going to lead to more sacks. That's why when you look up, you see Randall Cunningham was always at the top of the list of guys getting sacked too much. It's largely for that reason. It's why I was never that inclined to cut Ryan Tannehill, but so much slack in Miami for how much he gets sacked, and the argument was that he had a bad line. He did have a bad line, but he was also responsible for the fact that he wound up getting sacked. If you need a case in point in that, Andrew Luck was a good example where he was under heat a lot, but not necessarily taking a lot of sacks because he figured out how to get the ball out, right? Look at Patrick Mahomes in the Super Bowl. Under all that heat, only got sacked 3 times, which seems crazy given what we saw in the course of that game, right? Sacks are on the quarterback. So Russell did put it in there, hey, it's all me too, but he seemed to make it clear that he wanted some help along the offensive line. Then the next day, Dan Patrick comes out and we get like what seems to be a little bit of a leak that's involved with the Seahawks not being happy with the fact that Russell took that to the radio instead of bringing it to them. Now, I understand why the Seahawks would be upset, and this is the reason why I don't blame them. The dude who goes out of his way to make sure never to say anything got out there and said something. Nobody's going to believe that's an accident. Not after all these years of him not saying anything. Nobody's going to believe that he just slipped and it just came out because he was having this natural moment. No, nobody's going to believe that. He wanted us to know that he wants the Seahawks to get some help along that offensive line. Now, did he go talk to the Seahawks first? I have no idea. if he did not go talk to the Seahawks first, would I understand them being upset? Yes. Is it possible that he's been saying the same thing for years and then finally got fed up? All of these things are entirely possible. I really have no idea. But I am peeping the way that people around football are observing this, because they seem to be, I don't know if fear is the right word, but there's a definite note that the Deshaun Watson situation and how it plays out is speaking to the increase in power that quarterbacks have. And the term that we keep seeing people break out is, it's creating an NBA kind of situation. That's what everybody always throws it to, is the NBA, right? Now, never mind the fact that baseball got that set up where if you play 10 years in the league and 5 years with one team, then you get a no-trade clause automatically, which gives you a lot of the power that we are talking about here. No, the way they look at it, NBA players are the only ones that are able to flex and ever get anything done, and every sports league is afraid that they're going to turn into the NBA. That's what they are all petrified of, is that move right there. However, we don't know if Deshaun Watson is going to get traded, and we don't know if Seattle is actually going to do what Russell Wilson has asked them to do. We have no idea. Like, I'm going to tell you this much. This whole league ain't going to hell, or this whole league ain't going NBA just 1 year after the Packers drafted Jordan Love. You know what I mean? Like, if we was really this close to being the NBA, the Packers don't make that move, drafting a backup quarterback or the next quarterback when they have one of the two best quarterbacks in the league right now. That isn't what the play is going to be. But I do wonder this about Russell Wilson, because, Gabe, I joked about this on television. I can't remember if they put it on the air. But I'm going to ask you this. How long you think it is before people start blaming Sierra for us having more to say when he used to be so quiet and docile and agreeable and appreciative?
How long have they been together?
I guess it's about 4 or 5 years now. I'm not sure.
Because the public persona of him certainly changed in terms of how many like commercials he was doing.
Yeah, well, he's more famous.
I guess I'm just interested to know what else is changing aside from that in terms of the tone that you see from him.
The fact that he got on the radio saying, I need some help on the offensive line.
It's right? Taken a long time, though.
I didn't say whether that was right. I said, how long is it before somebody does it? And for what it's worth, I don't think it would be a crazy thing for people to bring up in this case. And this is why there's a misogyny that play when these things come up and everybody just always like, this woman got you out here doing da 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 and all this stuff. However, Russell Wilson is the star of the Seattle Seahawks. All right. Sierra herself is a star, but a star that exists in a different world. In Sierra's world, I don't know what's the same thing as an offensive line, right? Like maybe the dance crew behind her or whatever it is, right? But if Sierra feel like that dance crew behind her ain't getting it done, guess what? It's about to be some new dancers. It ain't Sierra walking in and asking, hey, you know, guys, I'd really like some new dancers if you could. No. Dancer's going to be in there. It's going to be some new ones. I do imagine for her, I think this is also the case with Giselle Bundchen, what it's got to be like for these people who, when they walk in the room, they snap their fingers and things happen, and they look at this crazy football world and they like, wait a minute, they pay you $30 million, but they don't listen to what you want? Like, that doesn't make sense. That can't make sense to them. And it honestly doesn't make a great deal of sense to us when we stop and think about it. It doesn't. So no, I would not be surprised if she's like, well, if you want them to get you this, why don't you just say something? You know, because I think a lot of times we get caught in the weeds of what sports are and what all these things are that we do, that we can often lose sight of like some very simple types of things like that. And I would not be surprised if she over there like, and not that she, and again, this isn't born of the misogyny or thinking that this is a bad thing, but I do bet that these men who are married to these women who have some clout and have some sway are like, yo, you know, you ain't got to take this, right? Because the truth is, Russell Wilson doesn't really have to take it, but Seattle thinks he does. Because this is what's wild to me about the thing with him and the offensive line. The quarterback should never have to tell the team, I need better offensive line. Ever. If you are invested in Russell Wilson in the way that they are invested in Russell Wilson, you have a quarterback who, when he retires, is probably going to be in the Hall of Fame. Generally speaking, don't you think that their groove would be, All right, well, at the very least, let's make sure he's upright. If for no other reason than you just spend so much money on him. Right? Let's make sure this thing we paid a lot of money for, let's get it a security system. You know, like, okay, you went out here and got this Bentley, you might want to get an alarm. It's not the worst idea in the world. Why in the world does he even have to ask them or bring this up as something that they need to do? That's my first question, right? One thing that he said on the Dan Patrick show, he's like, yeah, I feel like quarterbacks should have a little more input about what goes on with the team. And he's right. And the reason I think that he's right about that is there's a reason why Russell Wilson do all these interviews all the time and don't say nothing. And the reason is he's management. Quarterbacks are a level of management. And so they are far more likely to be wearing a suit after the game. They are far less likely to be out here just kicking it on social media like everybody else does. And when they do, they are typically very, very careful in the way they do, because quarterback has always been treated as a level of management, except they don't actually get to manage anything. Rather than being management, they wind up just being overseers. You know, you in charge when we aren't around, but then when we come around, you just like the rest of them. So yeah, if you're going to have a dude kicking it like that, living like that, and you paying him that kind of money, yeah, that dude typically would or should have some level of input. It doesn't sound like Seattle looks at him as that sort of dude. It's not terribly dissimilar than if we look at the Packers. They don't seem to view Aaron Rodgers as that sort of dude. Now, we've seen different examples with different teams and different players. Clearly, Tom Brady is running things in Tampa Bay right now. Look, when they went and got Antonio Brown, whom Bruce Arians hates, like, okay, you've been put up on game. Like, okay, he is the guy who is in charge there. Peyton Manning absolutely ran things in Indianapolis. He was the guy who was in charge. They did on various levels whatever it was that Peyton wanted them to do. But overwhelmingly, most of these quarterbacks, you know, quietly when you look at it, they get treated like the rest of these players. And when their time is up, they get sent out to pasture just like the rest of these players. And so for Russell, what do you do if they don't get you the line help? That becomes the question. Because to me, it makes sense if you're Seattle to show a good faith effort and just to make your football team better and do something to help that guy out with what it is that he wants, which is also something that is beneficial to the larger operation. Right. Like, I don't feel like getting protection for Russell Wilson is getting what he wants, is getting what you need. Okay. You go ahead and do that. Or you can decide that you're going to let him know who the boss is. And that's a bad play. It ain't going to make him happy. It ain't going to look good to the rest of the team. Cause they like, if he's going to do Russell Wilson like that, no, that's not going to work in that play. It's not going to be it. So we're going to see. Like, I don't think this is going to turn into like any drama that actually gets into the season or anything like that, because Russell Wilson is just kind of opposed to drama. He's not a dude that's going to be inclined to get out here and make a mess. But please understand this. He is a dude who will flex, all right? Like, hey, how much do you know about the story of him leaving North Carolina State?
I don't know much at all.
So the odyssey of Russell Wilson is very interesting, and I've been watching this since he was a redshirt freshman in college. So his redshirt freshman year was 2008. State basically had four quarterbacks. One was Mike Glennon, who redshirted and was the first quarterback recruited by then coach Tom O'Brien. One was this dude, Daniel Evans, who I think was a walk-on at first, but his dad had played there and he just wasn't any good. Another was this dude named Harrison Beck, who was a big-time recruit at Nebraska, but then also wasn't very good. And then there was Russell Wilson, who bears no resemblance to any quarterback that Tom O'Brien has ever wanted to have. Tom O'Brien likes his big, strong quarterbacks, and in comes this 5'10" guy who was really a baseball player, so forth and so on. But of course, Russell turned into a boss, right? First team, all ACC. As a freshman, his team exceeded expectations while he was there, all of this. And he had a 3-year run at North Carolina State where, other than Phillip Rivers, he's the best quarterback ever to play at North Carolina State based on what they did actually at North Carolina State. He's the best one. But at the end of his redshirt junior year, the expectation was that Russell was going to go to the minors and just play baseball. That was it. So senior day, his junior year, because he was graduating, they did up the whole senior day thing for him, right? They gave him his jersey and a plaque and everything because everybody thought that he was gone. And then after he's gone, he comes back to the coach and he says, well, actually, I'd like to come back. And O'Brien said, we've moved on, which he's gotten a lot of hell for over the years. He shouldn't have. He shouldn't have. Like, the guy said he was gone. And then if they don't start Glennon that year, Glennon transfers, and then you don't have a quarterback the following year. Like, I think it was a perfectly fair move for the coach to tell Russell, sorry, you told us you were leaving. We did the whole thing up. Now it's just a little bit too late. It's kind of like when Brett Favre retired and tried to come back. And they're like, nah, we've actually started doing something else. But don't you think for a second that in the background that Russell Wilson was not flexing? Because he was Russell Wilson at NC State. They love him. Don't think for a second that to get what he wanted, he wasn't trying to make it happen. And I'm sure in this situation, if it comes to it, he will try to make it happen. But he's not inclined to just say it with his chest. It's not him. So Seattle can be like, nah, we ain't worried about the offensive line. It won't be the end with Russell Wilson. And the worst part for you is it'll be not the end in an annoying way. Like, not even in a good one. Just wanting to be like, damn, Russell just keeps saying little stuff and then act like he don't mean it. Yeah, Russell, you was joking. Oh, yeah. Funny joke. That wasn't no joke.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
All right, Gabe, last week had all the false equivalencies popping up. Did you peep that? J.J. Watt got released by the Houston Texans. The way that it was termed is that it was a mutually agreed upon release. And I got news for you. Even if a release is mutually agreed upon, there's no such thing as a mutually agreed upon release. Here's why. Only one side has to say that they want somebody to be released, and then they get released, right? And so this thing pops up and they say that Watt is a mutually agreed upon release. I had a whole lot of people that were like, well, yeah. So J.J. Watt wants to be released. He can be released. But Deshaun Watson wants to be traded and he won't get traded. That is exactly correct. That is exactly correct. Here's the difference. One of them is one of the best quarterbacks in the league. One of them is an over-the-hill defensive lineman. One of them just signed a contract extension a few months ago. One of them has 1 year left on his contract at $17.5 million, and he only had 5 sacks last year. Yes, J.J. Watt is the guy who gets released. No, they don't trade Deshaun Watson. Why? Because they don't want to. That's why. This is the game. There's a reason why they call them trade requests and as sometimes trade demands, as opposed to I applied for a trade and it was approved. It's not really how this works. If they don't want to trade you, they're not going to trade you. With Watson, it's going to be a matter of, are you willing to miss camp? Are you willing to miss some games? Are you willing to sit at home and effectively say, I am willing to end my career rather than play for the Houston Texans? Because if he's willing to do that, then absolutely he will be traded. And if somebody walks in with 3 first round picks or something like that, then he'll probably be traded. But otherwise, he's going to be on the roster for the Houston Texans because they don't want to move him. They wanted to move J.J. Watt. They would have been stupid to keep J.J. Watt at that contract that he had. And I saw people who came back around on that and were like, well, I'm sure they could get a pick for J.J. Watt. They couldn't get a pick for J.J. Watt. Number one, team is not giving up a pick to trade for somebody who they think is going to get cut. That's just kind of a general NFL axiom. It's not going to happen. Number two, and perhaps most importantly, no one would trade to pay J.J. Watt $18 million on that 1 year. They would then need to extend him in order to make that deal more palatable, which means that Watt would have to want to sign the extension, which would mean that Watt would have to want to go there, which would mean, why are we bothering to trade for a guy who already wants to come here and is going to be able to do so shortly? That's it. This isn't it ain't what I think a lot of people would have automatically assumed that it was. And I understand why they might have assumed that, you know, why you would go in the direction of that assumption. But no, man, Watson, I'm not saying Watson played this bad, because if I were Watson, I would have signed that extension when he signed it, because that's just the kind of thing that you got to do. You got to take that money while it's out there. But he doesn't really have any leverage here. The only leverage he's got is the willingness to throw a tantrum, if he's willing to throw a tantrum. I don't know if he's willing to throw a tantrum, but that's it. So there's a big difference between those two guys' situations and how we wind up where we are. Now, with J.J. Watt, a couple interesting things here. Gabe, do you know how many seasons J.J. Watt has played in full in his career?
Maybe five.
Been in the league 10 years. He has played six seasons in full. His first 5 years, he didn't miss a game. The last 5 years, 2016, he played three games. 2017, he played five games. 2018, his last great season, he played a full season. Last year, he played eight games. This year, he played 16. And in the last two seasons, J.J. Watt had a combined nine sacks. This is a dude that's put up 20 twice. In the last 2 years, he's had a combined nine sacks. He's getting old. It happens, right? And we are seeing something happen now. And it happens all the time, but dudes just sneak up and get old on you. You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't even really think about it. And then you look up one day and all these dudes are old. Like, me and my buddies talk about this in rap. We're like, why are all of our favorite rappers old, right? But think about this. Cam Newton, he's already showing you old. Von Miller, he didn't play at all last year for a number of reasons. He had COVID and then he had, you know, whatever the injury was. Gabe, that sounds like old to me. How about you?
Yeah. $17 million for an injury prone player.
Yeah, not happening. Not happening. But dog, listen, when I run through this 2011 draft, which I contend is one of the greatest NFL drafts of all time, we're going to roll this 2011 draft and you're just going to be like, damn, they are all getting old. AJ Green, he's giving us all the old. Patrick Peterson, he, as a corner, he is done. He might be able to play safety, but as a corner, he is done. Julio Jones, he still looks like good and grown, but let's see, right? Tyron Smith, you saw the injury issues that he had last year, looking old. J.J. Watt, we just talked about him. Robert Quinn is already in the bounce around portion of his career. Mike Pouncey and his brother just retired. You go down this list in this draft, man. Cats getting old. Mark Ingram last year was in the playoffs and wasn't even being activated. Anthony Costanzo, he has already retired. Nah, Gabe, this is it. You look up and like Cam Newton's a guy that really fits this description in particular. It's hard to ever think of Cam Newton as not being young. Like everything about him was representative of youth. And J.J. Watt is interesting because he kind of always seemed old, you know, but this happens to us as fans where we just look up one day and our whole generation of dudes is just moving on. You know, a matter of time before we start seeing people talking about voting for them into the Hall of Fame and all of that stuff. Richard Sherman, he's trying to, like another guy from that draft, trying to find some place to play at this point, already been down in Achilles, you know, and everything else. And that was the thing about Watt. When these people are like, oh, somebody will give up something for Watt. No, you don't realize, man, Watt's old now. We just look up and your favorite players are old. They weren't old before. They are old now. Cam looked decrepit at points during that season. And that's where we are. Like, I was watching Patrick Peterson play some. You know, I watched a lot of Arizona games last year because they'd be on late and they ain't that many late games, but I want to get in and see Kyler Murray. And man, Patrick Peterson looked like he was trying to study how to spell people's last names. Running behind him, looking at that jersey, just looking at that nameplate.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're talking about players of that age, two players that retired early that are kind of from that same time period as far as prime. Patrick Willis.
Yeah.
Calvin Johnson. Patrick Willis didn't even get nominated, right? But yeah. Two players of that same kind of era, it's like, damn, they were in their primes 10 years ago. Now they're gone.
Yeah, it's funny. You talk about that same kind of era. What's wild to consider about them is they're kind of a different era. Like those dudes were drafted 4 years before these guys. Those are both cats from the 2007 draft. Now, what I am interested in seeing, we saw that run a couple years ago of these guys retiring young. Other than Andrew Luck, like this, he's not in this class, but like this class hasn't really seen that. These cats are trying to get this bread. Yeah, right. Like they're still going out there. But no, man, it's just what was one of the greatest draft classes of all time is about to cycle out of the league. it's just one of those interesting things to look up and notice as it happens. All right, so you may remember last summer when it looked like, you know, some of us was trying to get Iowa to fire Kirk Ferentz because they just been out there treating their kids bad and it got to be too much. And we started hearing about various racist things and everything else that was going on. And somehow they decided that even though Kirk Ferentz, the strength coach, was his right-hand man, that they were not going to fire Kirk Ferentz because he didn't realize it was going on.
Okay.
Right, but they did that. Strength coach was this dude named Chris Doyle. He was out there. And apparently his thing was he didn't just belittle the black players. Like, he's belittling white players for having learning disabilities, for example. Like, that was his kick. That was his get down. And he hit black people with stuff like, go back to the ghetto. You know, we're going to send you back to the ghetto and all of that stuff. And Urban Meyer somehow was like, hey, I need a new strength coach. Who's the best strength coach I can get? Okay, I will hire Chris Doyle. And then the word got out and people were not here for it. A lot of people were not here for it. The Fritz Pollard Lions was like, you must be out of your goddamn mind. You know how mad the Fritz Pollard Lions had to be. Like, it's one thing to not be able to get black coaches certain jobs. It's another thing when you see a white dude get a job who lost his last job because he was doing racist stuff. Right. And so a lot of people are like, well, Urban Meyer is about to learn that the NFL isn't like college and you can't get away with something like that. And I had a lot of people hit me and ask, like, yo, well, do you think that Urban Meyer is going to be able to make it work in the NFL because he can't just do whatever he wants like he did in college? And I'm like, OK, the question as to whether or not Urban Meyer is going to be able to work in the NFL and like how he handles the change in power dynamic, to me, that isn't really reflected in something like the hiring of the strength coach. That's not it. The question is going to come down to how Urban himself treats his players and how he himself relates to his players. So like Nick Saban, for example, like Nick Saban, when he gets all the way on 10 and we see that on the sideline, you can't do that in the NFL. You can do that in college. You can't do that in the NFL. That's not something I think of in line with Urban Meyer. And so I don't worry about him on that front. But I really did get to thinking, like, how in the world was it possible that Urban Meyer thought that he could hire Chris Doyle and that would just skate? And I know why he thought that it would just skate. Because he's done that before. And when you ask me, when did he do that before? I'll tell you when he did that before. There is a gentleman named Kevin Wilson. Kevin Wilson used to be an assistant at Oklahoma. He wound up being the head coach at Indiana, and he got fired at Indiana because of concerns over the way that he treated his players. Like, that was the issue, how he treated his players. Now, Indiana tried to slow play that, but we got this. One former Indiana player talked about Wilson forcing players to play through injuries. Another one said that the school interviewed five of them to talk about it. One guy suffered a concussion in practice before the 2015 season. His father said he was rushed back into workouts and then his symptoms went haywire. Listen to this one. It's one player. Kevin Wilson once ripped my buckled helmet off my head, spit on my jersey, and punched me in my chest during practice. The following season, Kevin Wilson was the offensive coordinator at Ohio State. And it happened without a blip. It just rolled through, right? And so a major difference between the NFL and college is that the NFL coach has less power over the media than the college coach does. The NFL coach is still like the king. He still has the power over his roster, not to the point that he can be petty in those ways, but the roster, like, he's still, Urban Meyer runs that operation, right? He is in total control of that. But the difference is, in the NFL, when you hire Chris Doyle, people pop up like, yo, dog, I don't know about this. In college, when you hire Kevin Wilson, people are just kind of like, oh, well, I guess it's okay. And then they let it ride. So my question came on this. Why did he hire Chris Doyle? Because he's been able to hire whatever coaches that he wanted, right? The question that we need to be asking is, why did anyone let him get away with hiring Kevin Wilson at Ohio State? And I'm sure that at that time, Urban probably said the same nonsense that he said this time, right? I have properly vetted him. And Urban got out here and said that he knew Chris Doyle from Utah, even though they didn't work at Utah at the same time, you know, but he got out there and said that. But the real question is, why media can shut down Chris Doyle working with grownups, but can't and or don't shut down Kevin Wilson working with powerless young people. Like I saw something, Jim Leavitt used to be the head coach at South Florida. He got the defensive coordinator job at SMU, and I read some story that was talking about him and like learning from his mistakes or everything else. Would that mistake be when he struck one of his players in the locker room at South Florida and he got fired because he lied about it? That dude's still out here working jobs, man. That dude's still out here getting jobs. And what normally gets you in that situation is not simply the striking the player, but it's the lying about it. Nope, don't matter. These guys just keep on going, and these guys just keep on getting jobs because the Urban Meyers of the world just keep on bringing them on, and they got the power in college. And so everybody figures either it must be okay, but there's no point in fighting it, no point in arguing it. Nobody over there is going to stand up for the players. But when the NFL thing comes around, what we will get up and say is, well, you know, the players aren't going to go for that. And then it winds up happening. But to me, the lesson from this Chris Doyle thing is less about Urban and more about the fact that we in our industry could have taught him a lesson a while ago. Instead, we just let him do whatever it is that he wants to do. And then we look up and say, well, Urban, it ain't college no more. Well, why the hell do we let college be college?
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
Today's If You Haven't Heard Difference Making Stories are brought to you by CarMax. Don't just buy a car. Love your car with the new CarMax Love Your Car Guarantee.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from tech.
Hi, my name is Dalvin Brown, and I cover innovation for the Washington Post. I recently wrote a story about a couple of startups that are racing to unlock holograms for the office. Essentially, there are a number of companies that envision a future workspace where people can collaborate via holograms. So as the nation eventually shifts back to working within offices post-COVID, this type of technology would enable people who are still working at home to beam a version of themselves into the office, or for someone in the office to beam a version of themselves into someone's home for a meeting. Most people are familiar with holograms, perhaps on stage doing performances, or maybe even from the Star Trek films, but there are a few companies that have figured out how to bring these types of 3D light projections to the masses, or at least that's what they're attempting to do. So one company I spoke to called Art Media has this idea that people would be able to beam presenters from one place to another. So perhaps an executive can't travel post COVID-19 or doesn't want to. They'd be able to use some light projection software, which they call a holopod, to project this presenter into, say, a conference space. And there's another company I spoke to called Mverse that has created software that would enable people to do that virtually. The idea is that you could beam your hologram into a virtual office and your coworkers could all do the same thing. And then you could kind of collaborate in cyberspace using VR headsets and a simple iPhone, according to that company. And, you know, the idea behind all of this is really just to create an engaging environment for workers who are either struggling with Zoom fatigue or are a little bit more apprehensive regarding going back to the office. This would just create an engaging, collaborative way for them to feel a part of everything.
Yeah, this is what I feel like, Gabe, and you let me know what you think about this, because I do understand on one level that this pandemic and the isolation as everything has taught us that in some ways we don't like always need to be there and like always need to be around each other. But I also feel like this pandemic has also taught us the value of being around each other, you know, like the value of proximity, as so many of us are largely deprived of it, that I get some of these steers and moves that people are going to move away from having to be there. But I don't know if that's necessarily going to be better for us in the long run. You know, so this idea of just piping things in, like all this stuff that is decreasing forms of human contact. I just don't know if that's good. Like, am I missing something?
I think the idea of bringing in like presenters or executives who are in other countries, you know, virtual via hologram certainly is like quite the cost saving measure. I'm sure paying for the software is far cheaper than paying for travel. You wonder how much it's going to change in addition to like, say, the workplace, how much it's going to change speaker tours, stuff like that, people doing talks at colleges and stuff like that, if that's going to change and they're just going to deem it that like, oh, we'd rather do a webinar than have them actually in person.
Yeah, but then I think the students, and it only happens before so many students, but you lose the value or the potential of like walking up and introducing yourself after and making a contact and making a connection. Like once we can safely interact with each other, we should try to interact with each other as much as we can. Again, like when I went and did that show for Showtime, right? It was the first time I've been in a TV studio, who knows how long. Oh my God, I had no idea how much I just missed sitting around talking to people. You know, just like being in a room, these people I don't even know. Just being in a place and talking to people. I feel like we are learning how much we value each other, but we're also learning how much we don't have to be around each other. And we're kicking it as though we ain't gonna be around each other no more than we got to. And I think that's problematic.
Yeah, and the two things don't have to be mutually exclusive, right? It's not like everyone is at home or everyone is in. This pandemic has like shown us anything, doesn't it? Hasn't it shown us that flexibility is something that could be good in the future where, you know, people only go into the office on certain days and then maybe those days alternate. You don't have to be in 5 days a week. You could be in 3 days a week. Just open up more options. If there's going to be a speaker, you know, maybe there's an option such that you can watch it virtually if you can't be there yourself. But there still should be the option to be there physically.
Yeah, I think we need to be careful before we let the machines take over our lives.
Yeah, 100%. All right, this next one comes from business.
I'm Lainey Welch, producer of Alaska Fish Radio from Kodiak, Alaska. The seafood industry is Alaska's top private employer, and seafood sales are on fire. How hot, you ask? A single king salmon is fetching nearly $120 to fishermen. That's the same value as 2 barrels of Alaska crude oil. And it's wild salmon that has fanned the flames at retail counters as more COVID-conscious consumers opt for seafood's proven health benefits. Before COVID, most Americans by far only ate seafood at restaurants, but now they're buying and cooking it at home like never before. Fresh salmon sales in 2020 jumped nearly 20% at U.S. supermarkets, topping $2 billion, and fresh fish sales overall increased by nearly 30%. Crab sales reached an unheard of 62% growth, and other top favorites were cod, seafood cakes, and halibut. Frozen seafood had the biggest sales gains, up 35% to $7 billion. Baby boomers were the biggest buyers of on-the-shelf seafood items. Salmon products again led the pack with a more than 30% increase in sales. One of the hottest drivers was online e-commerce seafood sales that topped $1 billion in 2020, and those are projected to reflect double-digit growths this year. It's a fact that more people want to know where their food comes from. And just as more Americans are turning up their noses at fossil fuels, more are turning away from gut-busting red meats to wild, sustainable seafoods, especially from Alaska.
Yo, you know how salty the oil diggers are? That the salmon go up for the same price as the oil? Because I feel like part of that story is, like, also, you know, oil's been a roller coaster through a lot of this as it has gone on. Damn. Do you find yourself eating more seafood in these times? Because I definitely make sure I get some salmon whenever I go to the grocery store.
I'm a vegan.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes, yeah, so I don't eat fish, but certainly do see a lot more Instagram ads for things of that like, where it's like, oh, fresh. It's kind of like ads that you've done on this podcast for, you know, delivering butcher meat, that sort of thing. You start seeing that with Alaskan fish that you can get delivered to your house. And I've never seen that before.
Yeah, well, it is. I found it interesting when she said that. I hadn't really thought about it, though, about the idea that most people just get seafood at restaurants. that they don't get seafood themselves, which I think makes sense, especially with people who live inland, because like the quality of seafood that you're probably going to get yourself is not that great. Seafood is also not inexpensive for most people. So I can see it being like a special occasion sort of bag. But other than getting salmon, there's no other seafood that I get at the house. So I just never thought about that. The idea that that is when people get seafood. And I think part of what's happening too is that people are in, money's a little tighter. They're doing a lot more cooking. And so that leaves them inclined to try new things.
Yeah, 100%. You have like fish scarcity out there. So it's becoming harder to track down these fish. The price of fish is going to go up. Damn, those oil barons are going to be mad as hell, man.
We're doing it all wrong.
Remember at the beginning of the pandemic, wasn't there something like the price of oil had gone down to like negative?
Negative. It's a roller. I don't know how anybody lives the oil life. I do not.
Crazy. All right, this last story, it's a local news story, but it's also something that's happening quite a bit nationally.
I'm Michelle Wiley. I'm a reporter at KQED, the NPR affiliate in San Francisco. So in late January, there were a series of attacks on Asian and Asian American elders in the Bay Area. And these attacks are examples of what appear to be an uptick in attacks against the Asian American and Pacific Islander community across the U.S. A recent report from Stop AAPI Hate, which asks people to self-report hate incidents, found more than 2,800 incidents in the U.S. between March and December 2020. So for the majority of the pandemic. Of these, more than 1,200 took place in California, and 708 of those happened in the Bay Area. San Francisco had the most, with 292. Cynthia Che, one of the co-founders of the group that tracks this information, said that this is likely an undercount of hate incidents overall. There have been reported issues with the tracking of hate crimes both nationally and locally, and Che says people affected may not want to report it to the police because there's general mistrust or they've had a negative experience in the past. She also noted that a majority of incidents they documented were of hate speech or harassment, things that may not rise to the level of a hate crime, but are still really damaging and have long-term impacts. Che also said that anti-immigrant rhetoric from elected officials plays a role, including the racist language used by former President Donald Trump when referring to the coronavirus. So, in response to the recent attacks, the district attorney for Alameda County, where Oakland is, announced the creation of a special response unit focused on anti-Asian crimes, particularly against elders. But these attacks have also reignited conversations around policing in Oakland, with some business owners saying they want increased patrols and others saying a community response would be more effective. Last week, more than 36 Asian American organizations issued a joint statement calling for a non-police response, like patrols by volunteers and tailored support for victims that will be more culturally competent.
Yeah, so I had seen these stories and as these things, you know, were coming out about the increase in hate crimes against Asians. And I do remember that, you know, when the pandemic first hit, that you had a lot of that. Like I remember Pablo was telling me about somebody that he knew who was just Asian person who was sitting on the train and somebody just explicitly looked at him and covered their face. Like they wanted them to know that this was the thing. And I had thought that that kind of stuff, they just dissipated as we stopped thinking about, you know, this virus in the context of China. Although I guess not all of us stopped thinking about it in the context of China. Some people never stopped thinking about it in the context of China. Damn, what they do to y'all, man? Like, you can raise this question, I guess, about just about everybody else, but I still look at that. And I'm like, damn, what they do to y'all? Man, general unhappiness is manifesting itself in the news in so many terrible ways. And of course, people look somewhere outward to lash out at. And I've always said the thing about Asians in this country is they are the most otherized ethnic group of people. You remember that time where Shaq was like, I got something to say to Yao Ming, ching, ching, choing, choing, choing. He did all that stuff. People just always feel like they can get away with it in like these nonviolent ways. And now they're going to the next place.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So a listener tweeted at me and asked if we could do a voicemail segment about getting a boot on the car, getting towed. Have you had a experience with getting your vehicle towed before?
Oh, yeah, man. I was sitting at work one day and my homeboy was like, yo, did you park on the street outside your office? Yeah, what's up? Your car getting towed. I ran outside, man. That thing was on the gasoline running down the block. Then there was the boot man. because our campus just didn't have adequate free parking. And so the boot man, like, you park in a parking lot, the boot man come put the boot on. Boot man, most hated man on campus. Absolute most hated man on campus. The most beloved man on campus was the anti-boot man, which is the dude who figures out how to take the boot off. However, that dude always himself winds up getting caught by the boot man. I hate the boot man to this day. He had a bumper sticker that said he was the proud parent of an honor roll student at Panola Way Elementary School. I think that's what it was called. And I wanted to call the state and accuse him of not treating that child well.
So that's a very specific experience or a very specific example of the boot man.
No one's ever had a good experience with him because I'm convinced the boot man was getting paid by the boot. Like, he wasn't working by the hour.
All right, our first one comes from Eric in Baltimore.
But it's about 2003, and I was in the Navy at the time. I was stationed in Bethesda. I had gone to Baltimore to see a show at the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall to see Dennis Miller, and I parked my car at a CVS because I couldn't find where to park the car there at the venue. When I came out, like an hour and a half later, 2 hours later, I walked over, my car was gone. And I went inside and I asked the security guard there at the door. I said, "Hey, do you know if they towed a car tonight?" He said, "Yeah." He's like, "Was it a gray Mustang?" I said, "With Texas plates." He said, "Oh yeah, they towed that." And he said, "Yeah, they called for you like 3 times over the PA and nobody came." I said, "Damn it." And he said, "Yeah, when it says Rite Aid customers only, that's what it means." So that's my experience. It was $218 and I showed up the next day with $220. And they said, "Well, we don't have change." And I said, "Just keep it."
Man, other thing about getting your car towed is this. That tow lot is never anywhere you want to be. Like, getting your car back after it's been towed, no one ever says, "You know, it didn't go as bad as I thought it would."
How much satisfaction do you think that the security guard got about saying, "That's why you don't park in the parking lot. CVS customers only, baby."
Yeah, boy. And look, that's so much easy money for CVS because everybody make that mistake.
The way that Eric said it too, "Has there been a tow tonight?" It's like, has there been a shooting tonight? Has something happened? As if it's such a big event.
Well, somebody always thinks they can get away with it. And I'm like, no, you will not. Not that one.
Oh my gosh. This next one comes from, the guy's name is P. He didn't leave where he's from though.
So it's when I was in college, right? And for whatever reason, like, the lady that was, like, she was over, you know, the whole complex. Man, she was just on one. She was just always on one. So my car had a flat tire, so I put my moving in the guest parking, right? So I had somebody else's car. It was a car that didn't have a tag on it. So, like, she had a car, and I'm like, I live here. You know what I'm saying? So I put it in the guest parking or something like that. And, like, I see the dude coming out trying to tow my car, right? So I come outside, right? And he's talking about, "Yeah, they called the tow thing on your car." I'm like, "Oh, yeah?" So he had the hook. He had the hook on my car, right? So I went under the car. I took the hook off, and I jumped in the car. I was out. You know what I'm saying? So he just looked. I'm like, "Yeah, nigga, you ain't towing this car." You know what I'm saying? So that was the one time where they tried to tow my car. But, yeah. Now, she did get my other car. She got, like, my car with the flat tire. She towed it because it had a flat tire. It was in the guest parking. So she got me then. But with the other car, no. I unhooked it myself and I drove off. Left them all stuck.
Yo, let me tell you something, man. My homeboy, freshman year, homecoming coordination. He had his date. He had rented a car. All of that stuff. And I forget exactly what happened. But, he liked his keys in the car. So he locks his keys in the car. Like, it's the worst night ever. He's got this girl with him. It's 1997, keep in mind. So we're not even talking about no cell phones, you know? And so he finally, he gets the tow truck to come and unlock the door. And so the tow man unlocks the door and he asks him, he says, "How much do I owe you?" And my man was like, "That'll be $75. He said, "I don't have $75. He said, "Old buddy tried to slam the car door shut. My man threw his body physically in there and was like, "That's what you're not going to do."
Yeah, the transactions that happen between, like, you and the boot man or you and the tow man to try and prevent them or to try and get the boot off or get your car off and get away. I had, like, a type of experience where I was picking up a pizza from this restaurant. It doesn't have a parking lot. Right next to it was a gas station. And the gas station has parking spaces in it. But in there, it says parking for gas station business only, no parking for this pizza place. I was only going to be there for 30 seconds, top.
Yeah, that's what they all say. 60
seconds. Pull in, park, go get my pizza. Before I even get out, tow truck pulled up on my car, starting to raise it. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I wasn't even there for that long. So this guy was just, the dude who was running the gas station is just looking for these people.
Yeah, he's waiting on you.
He's waiting on you.
He was like, I could get away with it. Like that. Look, that time I got my car towed, there was so many people illegally parked. And my thought was, they can't tow us all. Yes, they can.
I'm starting to make the calculation in my head like, okay, how much is it going to cost to get my car out of the impound? How much is it going to cost to get it off the tow? Dude's like, if you pay me $200 cash right now, I'll take it off.
Oh, yeah.
Went in, hit the ATM, wallet $200 later.
They have the leverage.
The last one. The guy is from Georgia, didn't leave his name, but it's a good one. It's a boot story, so we have some proper interpretation of the question here.
Man, so that was this one time we left band practice. I'm not going to say where, but we were definitely close to Georgia. And there was a guy putting a boot on our car. And we, as drummers, pretended to be freaking Ninja Turtles with our sticks, walking up to the dude thinking, yeah, you know, a little scare him. All right, maybe he'll let us go. He'll take us to something. I don't know. We was in college, man. And the guy jumps up and literally starts to play along with us, and we could not figure out what was wrong with him. Well, by the end of him putting a boot on, he lifts his shirt up and says, yo, bro, I was a Ninja Turtles fan as well. He said, but I got one question. Now, mind you, we were pretending, so it was another guy. He ain't never seen Ninja Turtles, man. I don't know how it's possible. He never saw him. And out of all the people to pick, the tow truck driver picks him and says, I'll take the boot off if you can answer one question for me. So we're standing there, and we're like, yeah, what's up? So the guy asked the man, he goes, you, what was the Ninja Turtles' favorite food? Now, immediately, three out of the four people wanted to say the answer. And he said, no. I want him to answer it. The guy shouts out, hamburger. We look at
him.
The boot guy, or tow guy, whatever you want to call him, turns around, puts a second boot on the other side of the car, and says, that was the dumbest answer I've ever heard. Gives us his card and says, call me when you got the right answer.
I have to say, I was positive that a pistol was coming out in that story. Like, when he pulled up his shirt, I was like, oh, yep, that sounded like y'all thought y'all was going to scare him. I was like, yo, one thing you need to understand about the tow man, anybody that does anything that involves a tow truck as part of their job, factory installed in that glove box. Mr. Do-Right, that act right. Mr. Do-Right is the Billy Club, but that act right is right there ready for you. I don't know how many people want to admit to be repo man, but if we open up the voicemail story, every repo man, there is not a, I told you this, I had a professor in college. He said he used to ride around with the repo man when he was in high school. And he thought about how much fun it was because they go jack these people's cars up. They hear him screaming and cussing and all this stuff from the inside. He said, till that one day they went to go hook up that truck and dude came out the window with that thing. And the repo man came back with his thing. And my man, the teenager, was thangless. As my brother said, if they had a meeting of repo men without guns, that dude would be the president, the vice president, and the secretary. The boot man has a gun.
Did they live by different rules? They have like a little kind of cheap badge, like a half badge?
Nah, they don't live by different rules. They live by the same rules as everybody else. And their rules are, I be doing something that makes people shoot at me, but what I'm doing is legal. Yeah. That's the gang. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane, how's everything behind the scenes? Thank you, sir. Also, thank you to CarMax. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Dalvin Brown of The Washington Post. Check out his story on holograms being the next post-pandemic workplace innovation at WashingtonPost.com. Thanks to Lane Welch of Alaska Fish Radio. com. Check out her story about the skyrocketing price of salmon. And thanks to Michelle Wiley of KQED. Check out her story at kqed.org about the rise in hate crimes against Asians. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.